Welcome, I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. Later in the show today, we're going to take a closer look at a recent Trump executive order that targets state and local climate change laws. It specifically singles out California's cap and trade policy. But first, we're going to turn our attention to Water for Life, a powerful and moving documentary that follows the stories of three indigenous activists from Central and South America who risk their lives to defend their ancestral lands and water rights from multinational corporations and corrupted governments. According to the latest report from UK-based advocacy group Global Witness, Latin America remains the most dangerous region in the world for environmental and land rights defenders. Every year, hundreds are threatened, criminalized, or killed for standing against environmental destruction. Made over the course of 12 years, Water for Life introduces us to Chilean Mapuche chief Alberto Curamil's struggles against hydroelectric projects that threaten the health of the major river running through his indigenous lands. The film also covers El Salvadorian farmer Francisco Pineda, which leads the charge against a gold mining operation that is poisoning the Rio Lempa. And finally, late Honduran activist Berta Cáceres battles plans to bring a hydroelectric project to the river running through her community. This is a really powerful film. Water for Life premieres on PBS this coming Monday, April 21st at 7 p.m. And for more information on it, you can visit our website at kalw.org. And now we're so pleased to be joined by the director and producers of Water for Life, and I'll introduce them one by one. Will Perinello has been making award-winning documentaries for the past 30 years, and he is the director and co-producer of Water for Life. Thanks for joining us again, Will.
Good morning, Ethan. Thanks for having us on. It's a pleasure. I want to just add that the film is on at 10 p.m., not at 7 p.m. on Monday, April 21st.
Very important clarification, 10 p.m. Monday, April 21st, and we'll definitely remind listeners of that at the conclusion of this segment as well. But thank you, Will, for pointing that out. I also want to welcome Rick Tejada Flores, documentary filmmaker with more than 40 years of work in film and television. Rick is a co-producer of Water for Life, and I hear is also a former KALW station manager. So Rick, so good to have you back on KALW.
Great to be back. Wonderful place to be.
Great to hear. And of course, we want to welcome our third and last but not least guest, Maria Jose Calderon, award-winning documentary producer, editor, and co-producer of Water for Life. Maria, welcome to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's wonderful to have all three of you joining us. Congratulations again on this film. We did cover this film a number of years ago, but we have a lot more to get to in terms of updates and, of course, this big PBS debut, which we're all very excited about here at KALW. And so I just want to congratulate and thank you all for making the film. And Will, let's start with you. You're focusing on a problem that has plagued indigenous communities in Latin and South America for many years, this idea of corporations coming in and before them, colonial governments really looking to exploit natural resources without taking into account the rights of the people, the indigenous people on these lands. So can you talk about what inspired you to make this film and why did you focus on these three specific leaders?
Good question. Thanks. I mean, you alluded in the lead off to the program about the number of people who are threatened and killed every year. Global Witness has been tracking murders of environmental and human rights defenders since 2012. And there are close to 3,000 people who have been killed in that time frame. Their last figures, I think, go back to 2023, when close to 200 alone were killed in Latin America. That impunity that's based around exploitation of natural resources was something that I was outraged by when I learned about those statistics. And I thought these stories need to be told. And oftentimes, you know, the perpetrators of this impunity and exploitation are corporations that we may, in fact, have our retirement accounts invested in through 401ks and so forth. And I thought, you know, if people were aware of what was happening, they would be more concerned. And in countries that are in our own backyard, but that we don't think a whole lot about. And choosing the three stories, Vicente Franco, who's the director of photography on the film and really my partner in the production every step of the way, he himself is an Academy Award nominated filmmaker. When we filmed Francisco Pinedo's story beginning in 2010, when he was receiving the Goldman Environmental Prize, and we had a commission to make a film about the prize winners that year, we flew back late in December and we looked at each other on the plane and we said, we have to make a film about this band's story. It encompasses the issues around environmental exploitation perfectly. You know, it's encapsulated because within a very short period of time, because of a presidential election coming up, the issue of mining became something that the media looked into, and 85% of the people in the country were against it. The sitting president, a conservative who saw that he was terming out, he saw that the conservative party member from his party, the Arena Party, was losing in the polls, said, I'm going to ban mining. And by presidential decree, he banned mining. And this U.S. corporation sued the government of El Salvador and the World Bank Tribunal for $350 million for a CAFTA, breach of CAFTA, Central American Free Trade Agreement, and World Bank trade, you know, global trade law had been breached. And four people associated with the anti-mining movement were assassinated within a one-year period. Incredibly dramatic arc of a story. We chose to add two other stories because about 5 years into the project, and this was when Rick Tejada Flores came onto the project with us as a producer, we couldn't get arrested with the story. We initially were able to raise funds for the film. National Geographic was the first partner that came in with a grant. But El Salvador had kind of fallen off the map politically and no one seemed to care about it. And Rick and my filmmaking partner, who was only a consultant on the project, John Antonelli, and I talked, and they said, you know, I couldn't see this at the time because I had my head in the weeds. They said, we need to put together three stories. And by putting together three stories, you show these patterns of exploitation and impunity that not only happening in Latin America, but are happening around the world. And then suddenly it took off. I mean, I'm not saying it was easy to raise the money, you know, to make the film, but it was easier. People suddenly saw the stories when we talked about it in a global way, right? In terms of those kinds of patterns that are happening in Africa, in Asia, in the Pacific, and in North America now.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're listening to Will Parinello, director and co-producer of the film Water for Life. It's going to be premiering on PBS next Monday, April 21st at 10 p.m. And Will, just amazing your perseverance to get this story made. And I can't help but thinking that, as you note, that it's hard to get attention for a film set in El Salvador or about El Salvador. And of course, now with the news of El Salvador being the recipient of deported immigrants to this country, of course, I would imagine the situation has changed a bit, but I would be interested to hear your thoughts on that. But before I let you weigh in on that, I just wanted to go to Rick Tejada Flores, co-producer on Water for Life. And Rick, Will mentioned how you became involved in this production. Can you talk about your interest in telling these stories specifically and what captured you about it?
Well, I've always been interested in Latin American history and politics. My family's Bolivian. I did a film on Bolivia, did a film in Cuba. But before I go into that, let me just mention Bukele, who's the president of El Salvador, has just finished a meeting with Trump today in which he announced that he will not return the migrant who was illegally deported to El Salvador. So there you go. Yeah. Some things don't change. But so my interest, you know, was because of the whole region and the fact that nobody cares about the stories because nobody hears about them. We hope that if we tell the stories, people will care. And also, as Will said, you know, when I started the film, working on the film, I had a friend who said, oh, I did that story in the Philippines 20 years ago. It's all over the world. It is. And, you know, that's why we told three stories. And frankly, that was the difficulty in the film, because there are three stories about the same thing and you have to bring them out as individual characters and situations. But I'm very happy we did the film and I hope people understand it.
Absolutely. Well, and I'm really glad you mentioned Bukele in the Oval Office today and that aspect of it. And again, I do want to ask some more questions about that, but I just do want to go to Maria Jose Calderon to get your story, Maria, on how you became involved in this production and why the story was important for you to tell.
Yes. Well, at the time when I became involved in the project, I was living in Chile. I am from Chile, but I've been living back and forth between Santiago and the Bay Area. At that time, I was approached by Will Parinello when he was in that process of finding the other two characters. I think he had the second character, but he was looking for a third one. And I started doing research and field producing work, trying to connect with the Alberto Curamil and his family, his community. At the time, he was in prison, so it became a months old process of getting in touch with the community, getting their trust, especially. And then I can't remember exactly when, but I moved back to the US and I became more and more involved with the project. As I am a person from Latin America, and I could see certain things in the footage that they're hard to find. This is a 12-year process that they've been filming, amazing and sometimes very powerful footage, but it's a lot to grasp. I think it was good to have new sets of eyes and fresh perspective. And I'm very, very glad that I became part of this. It's been an amazing learning experience. And the reason I became involved, because always since I started making films when I was very young, I've always been interested in stories about human rights and intersection with indigenous rights, land rights. And this became a perfect project for me to work and learn and get more skills.
Well, it's quite a team assembled here for this documentary. And if you're just joining us, this is Ethan Elkind. I'm hosting here on Your Calls One Planet series. We're talking about the Water for Life documentary film premiering on PBS on Monday, April 21st at 10 p.m. And you can find out more information about it at kalw.org. We're talking to the film's director and producers, the director Will Parinello, co-producer Rick Tejada Flores, and co-producer Maria Jose Calderon. And I also want to open up the phone lines. If you have questions for these filmmakers about their process, about what's happening right now in Central and South America for indigenous community leaders, those environmental activists, the number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or if you have personal experience with some of these communities or fighting some of these battles, we'd love to hear from you. Again, 866-798-TALK. You can also email any questions to yourcall@kalw.org. Will Parinello, director of the film, let me go back to you. First of all, I do want to ask you about El Salvador now being so much in the news. I don't know what current projects you have, but have you noticed a sort of change in what perhaps the funding environment might be or the interest level might be in your film or other films now set in this country of El Salvador, which is suddenly now so first and foremost in people's minds, being the site of essentially a black site for deporting immigrants from the United States? And the Trump administration is talking about denaturalizing U.S. citizens and sending them to El Salvador. So your take on that now that El Salvador has become so prominent?
Well, I mean, it's very personal, quite honestly, because Francisco Pineda, one of our three protagonists, a farmer and his family, and Ricardo Navarro, who was our field producer in El Salvador, who's kind of the godfather of the environmental movement there. He's sort of the go-to guy when the media needs to talk about environmental issues. They're now fighting against gold mining again. The government of El Salvador was the first in the world to ban metallic mining. And that was about 7 years ago. And it's the sort of triumphant end to the story in the film. But we had to add a coda because on December 23rd of 2024, at a relatively quiet time in the media, Bukele got the Congress in El Salvador to rescind the anti-mining law, and mining is coming back. So the threat is back. And, Francisco says in the film, we knew we won the battle, but the monster lies waiting because when there's $1 billion or more of gold in the ground, they just hang around and they wait for an opportune moment. So we're honestly afraid right now for, I'm afraid personally for Francisco, because what he does and what Ricardo does is they stand up. This is what we see in the film, and now they're more threatened than ever. I think the threat is greater because Bukele is imprisoning people who go up against him, and there's a great deal of fear in the country and kind of the suspension of civil liberties. And he dismissed the Supreme Court when they weren't doing his bidding. He goes into Congress with an armed cadre when they don't do his bidding. It's a scary time, and mining is moving back in to the region. Mining is coming in. There are representatives from mining industry coming from China and Peru, and apparently the United States now as well. We've been getting updates from Francisco about what's going on there. So we're concerned, but they're brave, and this is what they do. They stand up. And in fact, they're going to be showing the film for the first time on the 28th of this month at a university in San Salvador. So it's real. It's alive. I mean, it's sad. On some level, we worried because this was a story we began filming in 2010. We worried if it would seem relevant to people. And while it's relevant now, it makes me sad that that's the reality, right? It makes the film feel more relevant than ever, but it's unfortunate that it comes at the expense of the people of El Salvador, who are predominantly subsistence farmers, and it's not really a tropical climate. It's much drier than people imagine, and they've had water issues for years there.
Well, it does underscore just the importance of having your film to be able to give people a better insight into what's happening in El Salvador. Rick Tejada Flores, let me go to you just to talk about how you were able to get access to these communities. And you have a remarkable footage of these three amazing indigenous leaders. Can you talk about the process for getting that access?
Well, I can't say I was involved in the shooting, but I understand the process. As Will mentioned, he and Vicente Franco, our wonderful cinematographer, met all three of these people when they all got the Goldman Environmental Prize, and even that helped the process. But you still, when a foreign crew comes in, there's a history of people waltzing in, taking stuff, and never being heard again, and misinterpreting the footage. So it's even though there was a connection, it took a while to build the trust, and that you cannot come in. And you have a responsibility when you film people. You really have to tell their story, and you have to be willing to go back and show it to them. And I'm glad to say they were all happy, but it's a very slow process. And then when Berta was assassinated in Honduras, we weren't there. So then you work with local filmmakers. If there's a story that develops, we can't just fly a crew back to El Salvador. We don't. It's very expensive to make films, and documentary filmmakers are notoriously underfunded. So we had collaborators and field producers and cinematographers, and everyone who worked on the project really cared deeply about it. So if something would happen, they could help us.
Well, you referenced the assassination of You referenced, sorry to cut you off, just wanted to let listeners know, you referenced the assassination of Berta Cáceres, who you have really remarkable footage of her. It's just heartbreaking what happened to her, and especially because you really feel like you get to know her and the peril she was in and watching your film. Will Perinello, anything you want to add about the access you were able to get to these leaders?
I mean, some of the scenes with Berta in particular, I have to credit Vicente Franco and his sensitivity as a cinematographer. I would say he's one of the top documentary cinematographers in the United States, if not in the world. And it is because of his sensitivity. It may seem like an obvious thing, but he films with headphones on. A lot of cinematographers don't do that. And he captured intimate moments with Berta and with a woman named Melissa Gilbert, who's a poet and a journalist who was a confidant, where she's talking about the threats and her real fear. And that's incredible. And that's footage that Majo found. When Majo alluded earlier to going through the footage, there's a lot there, and there's a lot that needs to be, you have to live with the footage, which Majo did, which was incredible. And to Rick's point, and sort of really circle back to your question, we went out of our way to intentionally partner with filmmakers in each country. Filmmakers are journalists. And so since Majo is here, I'd like her to speak about that a little bit because she was our Chilean partner and she became an incredible asset and went from being our field producer to becoming the editor of the film and inevitably a producer on the film with Rick and I.
Yeah, Maria Jose Calderon Majo, would you like to expand on that, on your role and exactly how you're able to really go through all that footage and get that access you're able to get?
Yes, well, there's two parts. As Will mentioned, at first I was working as a field producer, and once I moved back to the U.S. and things are still happening in Chile and we're still following Alberto and his story, we developed relationships with filmmaker, with a really good cinematographer there, Aldo Viedo, and Paulette de Masseur. I can't pronounce her last name, but what she is an amazing investigative reporter in Chile, and she continued doing some work and getting some very important interviews, like the interview with the Minister of Energy in Chile. That was very important for us, just to have both sides of the story. We already had Alberto and his community, but it's really important to portray different sides of the story, make it a more powerful film. And in terms of, looking, and as Will said, living with the footage, I spent months just watching the footage. I think it took me 3 months to just make sure that I saw everything and take notes and then report back to Rick and Will, the rest of the team. It's a big, big team. And there were some treasures in there. That's the part that I love about my work, being an editor, just like looking at the footage and finding these little treasures that you overlooked at some point. And there was that moment of Melissa Cardosa, the poet, and Berta, who people will look at it in the film. And to me, it's one of the most powerful moments in the film. And yeah, Vicente was there in the right moment and just captured Berta, not because she was a very good speaker, an amazing activist, powerful persona, but we see her as Berta feeling the fear. Like, I mean, her work and the work of these activists, it's so demanding and incredibly, I mean, the amount of pressure that they have. They're doing the work that nobody else wants to do, like standing up against the biggest corporations. And, you know, they knew that at some point something could happen to all of them. Alberto, Francisco, Berta. I mean, Berta got assassinated. But yeah, the toll on the characters and their families is just huge. And I'm just humbled that I was able to be there and help to bring these stories to light.
You know, it's such a story of bravery, really, first and foremost. We're talking to the filmmakers of the PBS documentary Water for Life, premiering on PBS on Monday, April 21st at 10 p.m. This is Ethan Elkind. You're listening to Your Call's One Planet series. And Maria Jose Calderon, I want to ask you about the danger that activists like the three that you profiled in the film face in Latin America. That region continues to be one of the most dangerous in the world for indigenous environmental activists. Can you talk about why Latin America remains such a deadly place? And I have to cite even a story from Chile, which is currently under a relatively left-wing president, where a Mapuche indigenous leader disappeared from her community, potential target of, you know, people cracking down, the government or other people cracking down. I shouldn't say the government, but some people could be cracking down on environmental activism, and she could be a victim of it. It was profiled in The Guardian. So just explain a bit more about why this region, why Latin America, why Chile?
Well, I'm going to speak for Chile. The person that you're mentioning, her name is Julia Chunil, and she's an elder Mapuche activist. She had been fighting to protect native forest from development, from the timber industry. And there's a very, very wealthy man that owns the land right next to hers. Well, I mean, he purchased land that used to be her family's. This is all Mapuche territory that was stolen. In the past, it's a process that's been happening in the past 150 years. The same case of Alberto, they're reclaiming land that is ancestral to their community. And I think, I mean, this could have happened to Alberto, but in Chile has happened more to women that have been disappeared or killed. There's the case of another Mapuche activist that was assassinated a couple of years ago for also trying to stop a hydro project. I think, I mean, Chile and many countries in Latin America would experience dictatorships, and those dictatorships changed the countries and the social fabric. In the case of Chile, water was privatized. The land was also privatized or taken from indigenous communities, farmers. And there's a huge deal of impunity. I mean, during the Pinochet dictatorship, more than 4,000 people disappeared. Some of them appear, their bodies were recovered, but there's still more than 1,000 people that were never found. So, and most of the people that committed these crimes are living in impunity. They received amnesty, and sometimes lower rank officers or just a couple, not everyone, paid for their crimes, including Pinochet, who died without going to prison for committing crimes against humanity. So when there's impunity like this, it's easy for a company to hire people to get rid of whoever's stopping their business. So, and they know that there's impunity and they can get away with it. So I think that's the main reason why things like this happen. And it's very unfortunate and it's very troubling that it's still happening. I mean, Julia has been gone. She disappeared and I think it's January and like, we don't know where she is, and the government hasn't really said anything, and it's like she vanished.
Yeah, it's such a disturbing story. Yeah, Will, please.
It's worth mentioning that, you know, there's a far right-wing group in Chile that has perpetuated a great deal of violent crime against the Mapuche people. And I don't know, you know, Maho, how far we need to go into that. But just to give context, it's sort of like, you know, amongst ourselves, we refer to them a little bit as being like the Proud Boys of Chile. And so they feel that the Mapuche do not have the right to be back on their ancestral lands. And they are there as farmers, and they want access to that land, and they don't want the Mapuche on that land. Mm-hmm. So that's where some of the violence comes from. I don't know about this particular instance. I'm not speaking about this instance because I'm not familiar enough with it. But in general, yeah, that's the case.
Yeah, no, thank you, Will, for adding that detail. Rick Tejada Flores, co-producer on Water for Life, anything you want to add about the situation facing environmental leaders in these Latin American countries?
Well, it's desperate because for better or worse, you don't have a sense that justice is equally applied in Latin America. And one of the amazing things we found out was the story of Berta Cáceres, who was killed, and everyone suspected that the people she had defeated were behind it. And then lo and behold, they were actually arrested and convicted, which is just astonishing. But unfortunately, unlike the rest of the stories, it's the exception. It doesn't happen that often. I can't figure out how that happened in Honduras, because the company was closely connected with the government, and the head of the company was convicted of being the intellectual author of the crime. So, you know, that's a teensy ray of hope, but it's certainly not the way things work down there.
Yeah. And Rick, just to stay with you, any updates you want to cite? I know you worked on the film for a long time, mm-hmm. and it's been out. We were able to cover this a few years ago, of course, before your big national debut mm-hmm. here, when, you know, as we talked about, El Salvador in particular is very much in the news. Anything you want to add in postscripts that you think it's important for viewers to keep in mind?
Well, I think as Will mentioned when he started, is you can't look at these as isolated incidents. It's a pattern, and multinational organizations, including many based in the United States, are directly involved with it. You sort of you get the feeling that corporations run countries now instead of governments, and we're almost getting to that point here. We may be at this point. So I think that's the message. That's what people have to understand, that it's not a strange story in a faraway place. It's a universal story, and we have something to do. We have the power to do something about it.
Yes. No, thank you, Rick. I think it's very beautifully put. Maria, just same question to you, postscripts, takeaways, that since the film concluded and as it airs next week, what you want people to keep in mind as a postscript to what you put together.
I'm very excited that people here in the US will get to see it, because it's going to show that this is a very long continent, that America is a continent, not a country, and that there are people fighting for climate justice, for protecting the environment. And they're hard stories, but at the end, they're also very inspiring. People that with very little have been able to accomplish so much through organizing and believing that it's worth protecting our planet for all of us.
Very well put. And Will, let me give you the last word here as we're running to the end here of our time. Any thoughts you want to leave for listeners?
Thank you. I mean, to be honest, part of the motivation in making this film, and I think our three protagonists would say part of the takeaway, was to try to inspire young people to feel that they have a voice, to not feel that they're unempowered, and that grassroots political movements truly affect positive change in the world. From the bottom up, that's the way to make change. Top down, much more difficult. And here are three stories of people who found something in their communities that they were unhappy about, and they were willing to put their lives on the line to fight against it. Now, maybe we're not all willing to put our lives on the line, but we're looking at a situation in our own country right now where we have to stand up and say, we don't like what's happening here. And community-led movements can affect positive change. So that's the takeaway, and that's what our three stories show quite clearly. So thank you for giving us the opportunity to talk about our film. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for coming on Your Calls One Planet series and talking about it. It's so important that this work gets seen, that your voices are heard. What you have reported on the film, again, is Water for Life, premiering on PBS Monday, April 21st, 10 p.m. Mark your calendars now. You can find out more information on our website at kalw.org. I just want to thank the three of you so much for joining us. Will Perinello, award-winning documentary director and co-producer of Water for Life. Will, thank you for joining.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on the show. Really, thanks for doing a great job, as always.
Thank you. And I want to thank Rick Tejada Flores, documentary filmmaker with more than 40 years of work in film and television, and co-producer of the film, as well as a former KALW station manager. Again, Rick, thank you.
Thanks. I really appreciate giving us this audience to talk about important things.
And last but definitely not least, Maria Jose Calderon, award-winning documentary producer, editor, and co-producer of Water for Life. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. And I hope all the Latinos tune in and watch the film. This is an important film to see.
Absolutely. Hope you listeners get a chance to watch it. And thank you all for joining. We'll be back to talk about Trump's executive orders targeting state level climate policies. So stay with us on Your Calls One Planet series. We'll be back after this short break.